Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It is Monday, June 15th, and I am your host, Scott Pianowski. And one of my favorite things to do on the show is to talk to old friends and to talk to old souls and people who know their baseball and have something interesting to say. And we're going to do all those things today with my good friend, DB Firstman, somebody I've known for over 20 years. We first met in Tournament Scrabble, and we both share a love of baseball. We're going to talk about a lot of that stuff today. You may know DB Firstman from their recently released book, Hall of Name, Baseball's Most Magnificent Monikers, from the Only Nolan to Van Lingle Mungo and more. Easy for me to say. I think all 5-star reviews on Amazon last I checked. So it's been a very well-received book. Came out earlier this year. A lot's been going on in DB's life. Let's get them in here. Let's start talking. DB Firstman, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Long time no speak, but it is great to see you and hear you.
Yeah, same here. Same here. We're going to have a lot of fun on this podcast. When we get to the draft at the end, we're going to draft letters because, you know, we haven't sorted through the top 26 letters. The country needs, in a time where there's a lot of unrest right now, I think the country needs our letter draft. I wouldn't care if we did 20 minutes on that, but we're going to talk about a lot of fun things and a lot of exciting things, but I think we just get to first just get the elephant out in the room. We're both baseball fans. This is a fantasy baseball podcast. And right now, a lot of people have said this. Emily Walden said this. DJ Short said this on Twitter. They say that they love baseball, but they don't like it a lot right now. And I think that's where I'm at. I'm frustrated. There's been a lot of news about the baseball situation in the last few days, and almost none of it is positive. And it's starting to see... like it's starting to seem like there could easily not be a season. Now, if they can't make it safe with what's going on with COVID-19, I get it. I don't want anybody's health at risk. There's obviously liability issues they have to sort through, and maybe those things just can't get done. But what really makes me nervous for baseball is that it just seems like there's a fractured labor agreement right now. And even if miraculously we had a solution for COVID-19 in a month, in 2 months, or even by the end of the year, I'm just worried that there's just really bad blood between the players and the owners. And I just think baseball's in a really dark place right now. How are you seeing things?
I concur with practically everything you've said. I think I have loved baseball since I was a small child. And right now, that love is being severely tested. I think the only, you know, the reason to not have a season, the primary reason would be COVID. And if it's not COVID, if you're not going to cancel the season based on COVID, then it really boils down to economics. And some teams really, you know, some owners of some teams really just don't want to put a product out on the field. They feel like it's economically beneficial to not play the season, to not bring the teams back in and go through the machinations of a abbreviated season, even if you have expanded playoffs where there's more revenue coming in that way. But the distrust between the two sides now, yes, you have players who are legitimate concerns about their health and safety and their families too. You know, where are we going to have players bringing their families to Florida and Arizona? Are we going to have them in their own cities? Are we going to, what's going to happen to the families? Where are we going to be playing these games? How many games are there going to be played? And then you have the whole situation of, are the players going to be receiving a certain percentage of their assumed salary? And that percentage seems to vacillate from day to day and plan to plan. Now, my concern with that percentage is I always thought that the revenue from ticket sales was something substantial. And if you're telling me that you can play a game without any fans, but still have the same revenue coming in, then there's a disconnect there. So I understand the owners saying, we're not going to pay you 100% of your salary. If they come back and say, well, there's nobody in the seats, so we have less revenue, therefore you're going to get less of your expected pay. But since we don't have open books, since no team seems to want to open their books and say, this is how much revenue we're losing by not having people in the seats, then you can't make a true and honest estimation of what that salary percentage should be. And so there's a total disconnect on the economic side of this. And then there's the whole, then there's COVID. And like I said, if it was just COVID, I'd say punt the season and go for 2021. If COVID wasn't the issue here, and it was just, what are these people going to be paid? Then, you know, it's a whole mess that is, you know, bringing up the whole CBA that's coming to an end, I believe, at the end of next year. So, you know, we had the situation with the free agent contracts and the suppression of salaries a couple of years ago, and now we're lurching into the distrust of players versus owners and owners versus players regarding finances and looking at the books and believing the revenue streams. It's a real mess. And, you know, for devoted fans like you and I and your listeners, it really tests our patience.
Yeah, well said. You know, I could checkmark pretty much everything you said. It's hard to take the owners at face value when teams get sold, the values keep going up, and there's been all this money. You know, the MLBAM deal was really large a few years ago. There was just a deal signed for extended playoffs that looks very lucrative. It sure seems like being an owner of a baseball team is a profitable thing. We see teams all the time who maybe aren't real contenders, but they can take the shared revenue and put it in their pocket and not even worry about having to compete necessarily. The Pirates can go 77-85, theoretically turn a profit. And, you know, what do they care? You know, sell off a few pieces at the deadline to trim some salary. It's a dark place. I'm at the point now, and I don't want to get us too bogged down on this, because I want to talk about the fun stuff, and they're not playing right now anyway. I wish somebody could look in the future and tap me on the shoulder and say, look, you just get to write off 2020. It's been a pretty lousy year for a lot of reasons. There are a lot of things that need to be sorted out. There's a lot of things people are scared about. But look, there's going to be a baseball season next year. COVID's going to have a vaccine. People, you know, these curves that we're looking at every day, those are actually eventually going to go out of our lives. We'll get a sense of normalcy back. I'm at the point now where if I knew that was coming in 2021 and all I had to do is lay low and be a decent citizen and try to figure out how to get through the rest of the year, I would take that in a second.
I concur. I think the reasonable thing to do is punt the season. Don't force the issue. I mean, you've had, look at college athletics. You have these football programs with early practices and they're testing their athletes and their athletes are coming back positive and they're shutting down practices. Mm-hmm. So that's just a small sample. I mean, when we start talking about 30 teams with 25 players, 26 players and more, it's just a recipe for disaster on a health spectrum standard. And if they're talking about signing a waiver, saying we're not going to hold Major League Baseball responsible if we contract COVID while we're in your employ playing these games, well, that's a total non-starter. So yes, let's punt the season. Let's hope for a vaccine or at least a cessation of the downslope of the curve, and let's just work towards some peace and normalcy for 2021.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to see how they can bridge the COVID thing where you can't ask the players to take all the liability of getting on the field, but the owners don't want to get taken to the cleaners if they've proven to be liable for not having a safe work environment. I didn't really do you justice when I introduced you, because I wanted to get your book out there, and it's a very juicy title. It took me about 10 seconds to say it. Hall of Name, again, is the book, and we'll talk about that more in detail in a second. But I want everybody to know who we're talking about here. DB... in their day job, data analyst for the city of New York. But check out, for somebody who I don't think has ever been a full-time baseball writer, DB has written for ESPN.com, Bronx Banter, Baseball Prospectus, the Hardball Times, and The Village Voice. So those are just the ones that I know off the top of my head. There may be other ones. I wish I had that resume, and I do this for a living.
You're very kind, Scott. I've been very fortunate to do some networking and have some friends in high places who respect my writing and will pass, you know, when there's an opportunity that presents itself to write about a topic, even if it's a one-off topic. Like the Village Voice article was on a Subway Series event a couple of years ago, and Neil DeMoss, who wrote for the Village Voice, thought of me as somebody who could add some context and some substance to the subject matter. And so I've been very fortunate to have a lot of people in my corner. And I mean, I will say, I think I write well, and I think I can express opinions and back it up with statistics well. But it's also helpful that I've never really turned a job down, and that's what I can offer as advice. When you're starting out, don't turn down the job because it's not paying well, or it's you know, you're not getting a big audience. It's practice, honing your craft over and over and over again, and learning proper English and learning, you know, it's detail, it's paying attention to detail. I mean, you know, yes, you're going to have some editors looking over your shoulder, but it's attention to detail. It's working under pressure. It's time constraints. And just take the job, learn as you go. And if you're good enough, people will start to notice. I mean, thankfully, social networking has come along, and, you know, between Facebook and Twitter, you know, I'm pretty well known, you know, but I also put out content that I think people like. So it sort of feeds itself. You know, people start to notice, and, you know, it's Christina Carl, it's John Thorne, it's Dave Schoenfeld that over at ESPN, you know, so these people start to take notice, and you start to get other opportunities.
Yeah. When you were talking about the advice about, you know, getting the reps in and saying yes to things, there was a wonderful article on The Athletic today where they did a roundtable with people who went to the Syracuse Newhouse School of Journalism. And we're talking about Bob Costas and Dick Stockton and Mike Tirico and Ian Eagle, just all stars. These are, you know, I didn't even name everybody. I think Beth Mowins was on that panel. And they were talking about, look, you got to say yes to things. And, you know, so you want to be a baseball announcer and they offer you a hockey job, take the hockey job. You know, or they offer you a sport, you know, they offer you a minor league job, get the minor league reps. You know, they offer you to live in a city you don't want to live in, well, try it out, see how it goes. And, you know, I found out when I was trying to make it in journalism, I mean, the best thing you could do was be reliable, get the reps in, and, you know, want people to give you more assignments. And what they would do is if people liked you, you know, if they didn't have the job that you wanted, maybe one of their friends did. You know, if the sports department didn't have a piece for you, maybe they needed a movie review. Maybe they needed something covered at the State House or whatever. And it's one big network, and get the reps in, build the relationships. And, you know, I mean, you've obviously done that again. You know, you're still punching the clock with a day job. But and are you still running your own blog? I know you had your own baseball blog for a while too. The fact that you've done all this while you're still maintaining a citizen life, I think, is very impressive.
Thanks. Yes, the blog was on hiatus while I was writing the book, but it's back online now. There's, you know, there's some content related to the book, but yes, writing makes me happy. Expressing myself and having good positive feedback, which, you know, thankfully I've gotten almost, you know, without fail, I've gotten positive feedback, you know, saying, and being able to, what's really important is being able to find your voice. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds a little tacky, but finding your voice in terms of how you want to present your viewpoints or your stories or what kind of stories you want to tell. I found quirky statistics interesting. I found, you know, names of players interesting. And so eventually, it took a while, but I did find my voice, and I said, this is something I feel comfortable with. This is something I can write about. And it may not have mass appeal, but it has appeal. It has, so there are people out there who do appreciate what I'm doing on a semi-regular basis.
Yeah, you got to find that passion in life. I have friends of mine. One of my best friends, Steve Gleason, is a school teacher by trade, but he's always loved music. And about 10 years ago, he said, you know, I want to learn how to play bass just so I can play in my basement or in garage or fool around with some friends. And, you know, 10 years later, he's in two really good bands that are professional and get paid. And, you know, he's still teaching. He's still, you know, preparing the youth for tomorrow. But when he wakes up in the morning, what puts a bounce in his step is he wants to jam to the newest Tom Petty song he learned or whatever it is. And, you know, you need that passion. And that's why I've been so lucky to work in sports. And yeah, I know I started today with how tough of a day it's been, yeah, the podcast that is. But, you know, we will get through this, and you have to do what you're passionate about. And I think it's so great that you found outlets for your passion. Let's talk about the book. You know, this book has to be great when Jason Stark writes the foreword for it. And you found this illustrator, Tim Godden, who just did lovely work on the book. It's a really fun, quirky, just cool-looking book. And our mutual friend Chris Morgan, I think what he did, the typesetting on it or the layout, he's just a great guy. We know him from Scrabble. So you surrounded yourself with good people, which is always one of the things you want to do for success, is be around good people. But let's be honest. A book is going to succeed if the writer does their job. And you cranked out 300-plus pages on baseball names. Just talk about the idea, when you decide to go for it, and you know, tell us about the book a little bit.
Okay, well, I have always been a bit of a word nerd, of course, with Scrabble, but I've also been a bit of a name nerd too. I've always been fascinated by names and their etymologies and their, you know, the origin stories, whether there's a particular nationality or ethnic slant to it, or, you know, they're named after a particular historical figure. You know, I just find it, I have a natural curiosity about these things. And in my blog, Value Over Replacement Grit, for those who don't know it yet, about 7 years ago, I started the blog, and one of the regular features was I was writing about the etymologies of baseball player names. And it was like Billy Joe Robidoux and Doug Gooch and Cal McClish and people like that. And just sort of giving the background of how they got their name, what their name means. And then a player profile of what they did on the baseball field and off the baseball field. And then little ephemera, like their, you know, anagrams of their names, what their names sound like. Don't get them confused with somebody else. And after a while, I thought to myself, you know, this could possibly be a book. And a book was one of the things that was not part of my writing resume. And it was sort of like one of those brass ring kind of things, like I'd really like to check that box off at some point. I'd like to write a book. So I went to my friend John Thorne. I'll call him my friend because he's been sort of an uncle to me in the baseball writing world. John is the official historian for Major League Baseball. He's written tons of books on the history of baseball. He's very well known and very well respected. And I said, John, I have this idea for a book. What do you think? And he said, I like it. And here's a couple of leads for small independent publishers who normally publish this kind of material. I went to them and I said, this is my idea for a book. And I gave them a book proposal. And they all said, and this was back in 2012, they all said, personally, we love the concept. We just don't think it's going to sell. And so I sort of, you know, I was disappointed. You know, I was a little bit like, well, I like it and I think other people would like it. But I put it aside and I focused on my blogging and I focused on my other writing assignments, you know, ESPN and other places. And fast forward about 6 years, you know, we're in the middle of 2018. The blog is 7 years old. I've written articles. I've written, you know, I wrote a major, research piece for the Baseball Research Journal at Sabre, which was very well received. So I was looking for something bigger to do, something different than what I had been doing. And I came back to the idea of the baseball names book. So this time, knowing that if it wasn't going to sell 7 years ago, it might not sell to a publisher this time around, I said to myself, well, the self-publishing world has opened up. Anybody who has a little money on their own and a little wherewithal and some friends who know the business a little bit can get a book out there to the public. And so I basically dedicated the next year to year and a half on researching the book, acquiring photos from like the Baseball Hall of Fame and the Library of Congress, and doing research in the Sabre Baseball Bio Project and newspapers.com and ancestry.com. And that's basically where the book, the genesis of the book was basically, it came from a thought I had 7 years ago. And it took a little boredom with the one I was writing to sort of kickstart me into actually going ahead and trying to write a book.
So tell me about, you get it out there, it's been published, it seems like it's being well received. How has everything gone since you got it out to the public?
Well, I would say half the battle of a book is researching and writing it, and the other half is promoting it, publishing it and promoting it, especially if you're self-publishing. I was supposed to have a major book signing event at Foley's Bar.
Right.
RIP. RIP. For those who don't know, Foley's is the quintessential baseball bar in New York City. Anybody who's anybody in the baseball world has stopped at Foley's and had a beer and signed a baseball for the wall. I was supposed to have a major book signing, a couple of weeks after the book came out. That fell apart. And then, Foley's is now closed. I sent out 55 advance review copies, which I paid for on my own. I didn't send out PDFs. I went and I did a whole run of advance review copies, and I sent them out to people, and I did podcasts, and I did radio interviews, and I did newspaper articles. I didn't say no to anybody because I knew I had to do all the legwork in terms of marketing this book. And the odds are very stacked against anybody who's self-publishing, but it is possible. And what I found is the book gains momentum the more people see it. And the reviews have been very positive, the Amazon reviews have been great, and people who have just known me from Twitter or from Facebook and have ordered the book have given me positive feedback. The book has been out about 3 months now, and it sold approximately 500 copies, which on a self-published book for a first-time author on a subject which is a sub-segment of baseball, it's kind of a niche interest in baseball. I think that's pretty decent. I think I'm pretty proud of having that sort of sales. We're in a pandemic. We have people out of work with no money. And yet people are going and they're buying the book and they're enjoying the book and they're telling their friends about the book. And so, it's not going to be ball four, but it is something that I am proud of and that I feel like, yes, I can check the box. I've gotten a book out there and it's been positively received. And so I am a published author.
Yeah, two huge wins. I mean, getting the book just written in and of itself is a huge win. And then getting it out there and having people like it. And now let's just get you to the next level and just get some more people to see it. And, it's funny. My friend Batting Stance Guy on Twitter, he wrote a book all about batting stances. He mimics batting stances. He's gone to a bunch of baseball teams and done it in front of players. He's been on David Letterman. And somewhere in that the front of that book, he said, it's my love letter to baseball. And I feel like there's a lot of that in your book, that in a sense, it's like, look, I've loved this game my whole life since I was a kid, and I'm going to pour some of that love into the book. Give us just a couple of the names that just give us a tease, give us a taste of what they might get when they open up Hall of Name.
All right. Every profile of in Hall of Name, and I've chosen 100 players whose careers span from 1870 through like 2010. So they're not active players anymore. I chose that specifically so that I could have a distinct endpoint to their careers, and I wouldn't have to worry about, oh, their season's still going on. So 1870 to 2010, 100 players broken down into four different categories. We have the ones that are alliterative or sound alike, like Scipio Spinks or Greg Legg. We have naughty names like Jack Glasscock and Johnny Dickshot. We have names that are melodious like Shigetoshi Hasegawa, which is the favorite name of the late Bob Shepard. If you asked, when Bob Shepard was asked, what was his favorite name to say over the public address over the public address system, he said, Shigetoshi Hasegawa. And then we have the ones where we just don't know what the parents were thinking. My favorite example of that was there was a hot prospect for the Orioles in the early 1980s named Drungo Hazewood. And Drungo got his name based on, he was the eighth of 10 children born to this couple. The mother, pregnant with what the child would become Drungo, the mother said, okay, we're going to have a foot race to the hospital. Whoever wins the foot race to the hospital gets to name the baby. So one of the kids wins the foot race to the hospital, names the child Drungo because it was his best friend's last name. So that's how Drungo Hazewood got his name. So it's etymologies of names. It's little quirky stats, little quirky trivias. Like, for example, Pete LeCocq. Everybody, most people know Pete LeCocq's father was Peter Marshall, the longtime host of Hollywood Squares. But Pete LeCocq in baseball may have ended the career of Bob Gibson. Pete LeCocq, in what turned out to be Gibson's last game, hit a grand slam home run off of Gibson. And Gibson, Gibson after the game said, when Pete LeCocq hits a grand slam off of me, I know it's time to retire. And that's in fact what he did. So it's stories like this, you know, it is, I give the etymologies of the names, the profiles of the players, what they did on and off the field. I mean, I'm not trying to make fun of the names. I'm trying to educate as to where did the name come from? Because let's face it, we're in America in 2020, and baseball is a universal sport. There's nationalities, there's ethnicities, and we're coming from it from a particular vantage point. So a name that might sound perfectly normal in the Dominican Republic might sound very odd to somebody sitting in Forest Hills, New York, in Queens. So I wanted to get the etymologies out there and do some detective work. And then I also wanted to show that the players were people, that they had lives, that they had frailties just like anybody else. We had suicide, we had murder, we had alcoholism, we had Ferris Fane in 1984. Former major leaguer Ferris Fane was arrested for selling pot, or growing pot, in his backyard. And then a couple of years later, he actually went and did state time for growing pot in his backyard. So these are the kind of stories where it's just like you get a sense of who these people are on and off the field. And so I really wanted to thread the needle of, I'm having fun with their names. I'm letting you in on the joke of, that's a really interesting name, but I'm also giving you some education as to here's what this player was about, here's what they did. And, so that's the gist of the book.
Lots of good stuff there. When you mentioned Pete LeCocq, it makes me think of one of my favorite Twitter follows, the 70 Sports account, which he'll every once in a while will pull up a photo of Pete LeCocq at Wrigley Field with his fan club, and they all have Pete LeCocq t-shirts. And I remember being in Tout Wars in the early 2000s, and Keith Law, very brilliant and smart and intimidatingly smart guy, was in the league I was in. And the way he pronounced Kazuhiro Sasaki was just so elegant and graceful that I swear I was in awe of Keith for like 15 to 20 minutes. I couldn't speak because I'm just like, what am I doing in this league with this guy? He's an Ivy Leaguer, and he's got like this computer in his head, and he pronounced the names perfectly. It was like John Miller was in our league. It's a really fun book. Baseball's supposed to be fun. And again, it's last I checked, it had a perfect 5-star rating on Amazon. And if Jason Stark's vouching for you, you've done something right. So and the illustrations are wonderful. The content in the book is really terrific. So I was proud to be one of the first. I did not get an advanced copy. I paid like any regular person, and was happy to do so. Tore through it in about 10 hours or so. I mean, it just sat in my reading nook. And every time I'd get a sandwich or something, I'd sit down and pick off some more pages. Talked about it a little bit with Chris Morgan, our friend, who I know was really invested in the project. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Good stuff. Go out, get yourself a copy. We need some fun stories to talk about in baseball, because right now they're not playing anything on the field. Now, as I said, we met during Scrabble, which is not really a part of my life anymore. I look back fondly on it. And then we played in at least one fantasy baseball league together. I know you don't play traditional fantasy right now, but it sounds like you've gotten the score sheet bug. Can you give people who might not know maybe like a minute and a half plug on what score sheet baseball is?
Sure. Score sheet baseball is, it gives you the opportunity to really manage a team in terms of actual roles for players. You set up a weekly lineup with a batting order against left-handers and right-handers. You set up your rotation, first through fifth starters, and then you set up your bullpen, and you assign particular innings for the particular pitchers. Like, you don't want your closer in before the eighth inning, or this is the first man out of the bullpen, but if he gives up three runs, then you pull him and you put in somebody else. Part of the beauty of score sheet is that defense plays a part in the overall total accumulation of statistics. And the statistics are really based on the actual games that are going on during the week. We submit a lineup for the week on Sunday that goes from Monday through the next Sunday. There is a computer that simulates the games based on actual statistics that are accumulated by your players during that week. So, for example, if you have Nolan Arenado as your third baseman and Nolan hits three home runs during the week, chances are good that on your team, Arenado will hit 2 to 3 home runs during that week. But the computer simulates each of the games that you're playing. So you have some control over what happens in the game based on your lineups and your rotation and how you set up your bullpen. But there is a computer that actually plays out the games based on the real statistics that occur during that week. And so you have, for example, JD Martinez is one of my outfielders on one of my teams. I pull him for defense in the seventh inning. Or I set him up as DH. And, that's one of the decisions that you make. You have to factor in defense, and all the players have defensive ratings. All the pitchers have weakness points and things of that nature. So there's a lot of skill involved. And what's really fun is when you have a dynasty or keeper league and you get to draft players. You can draft minor leaguers and watch them come up through the system, and then they hit your team, and then they're yours. It's like, hey. So it really is a lot of fun. And, you know, it's cool because for those who don't have a lot of time to dedicate to fantasy sports, who say, I don't want to do a daily league. You know, I don't have time for a daily league. This is where you set a lineup once for the week. You can set it aside, and then the computer spits out the results the next Monday, and you can see, oh, my team went 5-2, and here's, and they give you box scores of all the games, you know, and they give you the whole box score, and you can play out the games on the computer if you wanted to. It's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. One of the things I've been doing with no real baseball going on right now is DJ Short of Roto World got together 20 people from fantasy baseball, and we did a simulation league where we could draft any player from 1980 to 2019. And I drafted Albert Bell 1994 because that was the best Albert Bell season I could find. I drafted Dwight Gooden of your beloved Mets 1985. That was my first pick. And it's a lot of the similar. It's not the exact same thing as Scoresheet because that just is a simulation. It has nothing to do with what they actually do on the field. But you know, I have to set a lineup. I have to set a bullpen, a very bad bullpen, by the way. Other than Octavio Dotel, nobody can get anybody out because you know everybody I'm up against is an all-star team of offense. I mean, my team ERA is like 6. But it's a blast. We have a private thread on Twitter. We all talk about it, and we celebrate our victories, and we bemoan why our stars aren't hitting or pitching well. But it's all in good fun. It's really good people, and it's been a wonderful distraction during this pandemic. So, you know, look, we talk generally fantasy on this show, and I'm sure, you know, we're going to have fantasy baseball to talk about, whether it's next year, whether it's later this year, and I welcome getting back into that. I don't know exactly when it's going to be. But let's try to keep avenues open to different ways we can play fantasy. And, you know, for Scoresheet's one of those. And the What If simulation has been one of them for me. If people follow you on Twitter, Dianagram, Dianagram, they may have seen that recently you talked about a milestone in your life, an anniversary that you were celebrating, and just a change of things in your world over the last year or so. Can you just update people about what you've been going through personally?
Sure. I was born in 1963 with what's called an intersex condition. Basically, my body when you have an intersex condition is sort of a melange of male and female gonadal tissue, and in 99% of those cases, you're raised female because it's just easier to sculpt the body that way. The surgeons do their work, and you're raised female despite whatever else may be going on in your, you know, in your psyche, in your intellect, in your mannerisms. And so I didn't find out the truth about my condition until I was over 30 years old. That's a long story for another time. But I found out in my early 30s the truth about my body. I had some inklings about it, but I found out the truth. And I spent the next basically quarter century finding some inner demons as to who I was and how I wanted to present myself. And I reached a point where I didn't feel like presenting myself as female was really an honest feeling that I had. I wasn't saying I was male, but I wasn't comfortable expressing myself as female. So after a lot of a lot of soul searching and a lot of you know talking to various friends and people that I trust, I came out on December 9th of 2019, which was my half birthday. I came out as non-binary. Now, people say, well, what does that mean? That means basically you're expressing your gender identity as something other, as not male or female. It is something totally just, not related to either gender. It's not to be confused with being transgender. It's not to be confused with being, You know, it's not a sexual orientation. It is a gender identity. And given my life to this point, it felt like the truest expression of who I was. And since that point, I was born Diane Firstman, and I legally changed my name to DB Firstman. So that was another major milestone that occurred earlier this year. And I'm happier now than I've been in quite some time. I feel more comfortable in my own body. And it's really, between that and the book, it's been a hell of a year.
You know, when we started this podcast and we're talking on Skype, and when I dialed on, you were already talking with my producer, Raghu, and I came in right before we started. And it's been a while since we've actually, you know, been in the same room, even though we've played a lot of Scrabble together. We've been friends for a long time. But I could immediately tell the look on your face. It shows that you're comfortable in your own skin. You're in a really good place in your life. And I don't think there's any doubt that just shined through immediately. I could see it. And then when we started to talk and everything, I don't know. It's very invigorating to see that. I mean, let's face it. It's been a very slow evolution in our country for us to be accepting and to be inclusive and to be understanding of people who have different backgrounds than us. And I think that's a big hurdle for sports. I think it's a big hurdle for fantasy. And I don't know, just when we started this call and you started to talk and I could see the look in your face, I thought, you know, DB's in a really good place right now.
I am. I mean, it's there's been a lot of heartache. There's been a lot of soul searching. There's been a lot of dark moments, but I've come through and I'm in a much better place now. And it is a challenging time. I mean, there are people out there there are a lot of smart people who totally understand the concept of gender identity, who totally understand when, you know, I've met more than a few parents who say to me, you know, my daughter is transitioning. She wants to be a boy. My son is transitioning. He wants to be a woman. My child is coming out as non-binary. This is an exciting time for self-expression and for the expansion of what we understand to be gender and gender identity expression. That being said, there are people out there who will throw all sorts of crap, you know, at this movement, at this expression, and come up with all sorts of reasons why, you know, this gender identity expression is supposed to be harmful or bad or threatening. Like, well, gee, I want to go into the bathroom where I feel more comfortable. No, I'm not going to assault you. I just want to go pee. You know, that kind of feeling. It's really that simple. It's just that you want to feel comfortable going about your life, and the people who have a problem with it really have to take a look inside themselves and say, what's the real threat to me here now? Is it my own self-perception, or is there really an outside threat? Does this non-binary person or this transgender person really pose a threat to me? And it's really mind-boggling to see some of the responses, you know, out there. But it's also heartening to know that, you know, at least more people are being bold and taking the initiative to express their gender identity beyond something other than male, strictly male and female.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like, you know, who am I to say that I should deny somebody what makes them happy or what makes them feel complete or what makes them feel comfortable in their own skin? I just don't think I have that choice. And you know, tolerance is understanding, and tolerance are things that I think we need to focus on in this time. We only have a few more minutes, but we have to transition to our draft. So I'm going to ask you a question that really demands a long answer, but we only have time for a shorter answer. And I hope we can talk more about this maybe on Twitter or on a subsequent podcast. How can we be more inclusive, whether it be in the fantasy space or in the baseball writing space, in the Twitter space? How can we be more inclusive, do you think?
Wow. What's interesting is that, you know, since we're in such a virtual world, since we're in such a world where we are behind a monitor, you know, we're doing a lot of work remotely, there are fewer impediments. There should be fewer impediments in terms of, well, gee, the person says they're John Smith, but they're really Jane Smith. You know, so it's the idea of, well, gee, they're a woman, they won't know about baseball. Please, studies, there have been surveys out there that at least 45% of the American public, in terms of fandom, are female, you know, they're female baseball fans. And if we can get teams to stop patronizing women as some sort of wallflower, daffodil, oh, we only like pink, you know, that kind of stuff. And I have tons of female friends on Twitter who say, you know what, I really want a jersey, I really want a uniform top, but I don't want sparkles on it, I don't want pink, I want to wear what the pros wear, I just want it cut for me. And it's the little simple things like that to treat women and minorities and anybody really who wants to enjoy the game, and to not patronize to them and not belittle them for their interest. It's a really complex subject, and you're right, we should go on about this perhaps another time. But the fact of the matter is, if you're good enough to write well, it shouldn't matter if who you sleep with, who you are, you know, what your gender identity is. Can you get the point across? Can you make sense of what's happening on the field? And journalism is a tough field to be in right now, but I want people to really understand that, you know, writing is a passion, and, you know, anybody can have that passion. And, you know, you really just have to be open-minded to different ways of expressing your love for the game.
Very well stated, you know, and just people got to look around. I mean, a lot of times the critique is, oh, well, you know, men grow up playing sports, it's been in their DNA, you know, non-male viewpoints aren't going to understand sports, when there's so much great journalism being done right now that isn't by men. I have a bunch of Yahoo colleagues who are not men, who are doing great work on every sport. You look, if you want baseball, Fangraphs has a bunch of excellent women writers. You know, Christina Carl's story, she's written for just about everybody who's highbrow in our business. You know, Baseball Prospectus has always been very progressive about, just, look, we just care if you're smart, we don't care what your background is. And so I just like to think that our space is getting smarter all the time. And, you know, you don't have to be a guy to have been somebody who loves baseball, understands baseball, and can write about it, speak about it, or express it eloquently. And so, you know, let's just have more good conversations. And those conversations are all over the place, and I think we just get to seek them out and give people a chance and see what they have to contribute. Really enjoyed this conversation. We're going to switch to our draft. We don't have a ton of time, so we're going to kind of go speed round. We didn't talk about Scrabble. We'll save that for another podcast. But we both come from a Scrabble background. We both know the alphabet really well. I know you probably have a blank tracking sheet somewhere in your apartment, and God knows I do. So let's draft the letters. I'm going to give you the first pick. Again, we're going to go kind of speed round, but you're up first in our letter draft.
Okay, I'm going with the letter Y. Because it can be a vowel. And, you know, that kind of dual, you know, it's sort of like being a batter and a pitcher. You know, you can be a position player and a pitcher. The Y can be a consonant or a vowel.
Yeah, the Otani of the alphabet. I used to have a subset shirt that had all the vowels in a circle, and then the Y was, you know, toggling between the consonants and the vowels. And I remember Mike, I worked to a Scrabble tournament actually, and Mike Exidy looked at it and he just like cracked up. He said, oh, I love that. subset humor. So, you know, that's why you hang out at Scrabble, so you can tell those highbrow jokes. I'm going to pick the letter A. Look, it's at the first letter of the alphabet. It's just something classy about it. It's the grade you always want in school. You know, vowels are generally important anyway. If you put an A next to something, I think there's just a little bit of class attached to it. So I'm going to start my team off with the letter A.
Do you get a second pick, or are we doing snake?
No,
or
we're not snaking. You're going to get all the draft capital in your advantage.
Okay. I'm going to go to your neighbor. I'm going to go with B for baseball. It's really tacky, but B is it's my middle initial, so that's worth something. It was my mother's name. When you shortened Beatrice, it became B. And you know, it's a vitamin, so that's always a good thing. You got B6 and B12. And bees are very important to our ecosystem. So B is my choice.
Sure. And if you want to go baseball, you have the killer bees of the Astros, right? Bagwell and Biggio. So a strong pick in the second round. I'm going to go with the letter J. And in one of our earlier silly drafts, Andy Behrens and I drafted initials. And what we learned in that initials draft is that the J was just the chameleon of initials. Every letter just about the alphabet. I guess there's a couple of them that don't apply. But almost anything when attached to a J sounds great. It's just it's kind of a hit or miss Scrabble letter, but it's not great for bingos. You may get a 34-point play with it or something, but the J just it mixes so well with other letters. It just sounds really cool. Dr. J, almost any initials with a J. Some mesh better than others, but it's a very versatile letter when you pair it with another letter.
Good choice. For the third pick, I'm going with the letter Q. Okay. Q for the borough of Queens, where I was born. Q is one of the Scrabble tiles with the highest point value. It is a 10-point tile, so it's also very, very worthy of its stature. You can make tons of Q words nowadays because QI has been acceptable. And Q is the first initial of one of my favorite names in the book, Quentin McCracken.
Yes, so, Colorado Rockies, sure.
Yes, Quentin McCracken. And there's also Kilvio Varus and a couple of other Qs. Of course, we have Jamie Quirk. Q, that's my choice.
You know, a strong power tile in round three, but I'm going to take what you probably should have taken, the letter Z. Okay, because I get the Z, I get the Z. It's got the power of ZA in Scrabble. You very seldom will eat the Z, where you still occasionally will eat the Q in a game of Scrabble. You can't spell pizza without a couple of Zs. You can't spell pizzazz without a couple of Zs. You can't take a nap without a few Zs. You know, Z is what the Canadians call it. ZZ Top is a great band, great boogie rock and roll band out of Houston. So I think getting the Z in the third round is pretty strong value.
Okay, that was good. You're getting some late value. I like that. I'm going with F for my fourth pick. F for fourth. Also, F as my last name begins with an F.
It does.
We have the F scale for tornadoes, F1 through 5. Or is that hurricanes? It might be hurricanes. No, maybe it's tornadoes. I think it's tornadoes because I watch Twister about 12 times a year, and they talk about F1 and F5s. And so, and there's F. Scott Fitzgerald, F. Murray Abraham. You have great people with the first initial F, and they just list the rest of their name. And then F is just, you know, it's a classy looking letter.
You know, it's funny when I was thinking about this, and I mean, this is a silly thing to draft letters, but it's what I like to do. And I was pondering letters, and I thought, you know, I don't know if I can take F just because of the connotation that it's the worst grade you can get in school. And you kind of live in fear of the F, although I don't know, maybe now it's just pass fail, but even then, fail begins with F. But you made a strong case, and I guess I have to admit that, you know, my scouting combine stats on the F are probably misguided. So I will reevaluate that for future drafts. I'm going to take the letter H for Hector. H because it's, you know, A-I-T-C-H. It's got a neat spelling. It's a very versatile letter. It has good synergy with other letters. It's a really good letter in Scrabble. It makes a lot of short words. It can be a very bingo-friendly letter with the 4-point tiled that it is. You could score pretty well with it. Sometimes you slap a couple of tiles down, you score 30 points on an H. And just to put the coup de grace on this, a Scrabble story that will mean nothing to only you and I, and you know, maybe if Chris listens to this. I was at a Scrabble tournament once, and Ted Rosen was on a, who was just a very mercurial old guy, a nice dude, a New Yorker, was on this shuttle to go back to the airport. I think it was a Reno tournament. And to nobody in particular, he went off on like a 3 or 4 minute diatribe of how Joel Sherman, who is one of the Mount Rushmore Scrabble players, just a guy who's been a champion for like 30 years, he had told Ted Rosen to never get rid of the H, that whenever you're exchanging, you should always keep the H. And Joel Sherman told me, just, I don't even know who he was talking to. I don't even know if he realized that I was on this shuttle, but he just talked about Joel Sherman and the H for about 3 minutes. And I wish I had a smartphone then, because I would have taped it. And you know, this would have been like my most prized possession when I'm like 90 years old, Ted Rosen talking about the H. So I know that missed most of our audience, but trust me when I say I hold that story close to my heart.
All right, I believe it's my last pick. We're at round five. I won't go off the board here, but I'm going for the cheap points here. I'm going for the letter S.
Okay, strong pick.
It pluralizes everything. It's a great looking letter. It's got two or three curves. There are no straight lines in it. It's all curvy. You've got you know, the S curve itself. You've got, it's only worth 1 point in Scrabble, but it's really, really powerful. So the looks are deceiving. You know, when you have an S on your rack, you hoard it, you keep it close to you, you don't waste it. So it is a really important letter to have in terms of your Scrabble playing. And it just makes, it's just makes everything plural. You know, you had one, now you have more marbles. Well, you had one marble, now you have marbles. What could be better than having more marble than marbles? Or food, you have more foods. It's just, I'm rambling because it's late, but it's S, and it's my final pick.
Yeah, it's a wonderful letter. I think everybody who plays Scrabble gets that feeling when you get the S. Now you have the power to hook anywhere on the board. But also, it has synergy with almost the entire alphabet. There are a couple letters it doesn't play well with. You have to learn when you play Scrabble, the D and the S don't go well together for whatever reason. But the S is very good at starting words. It's very good, certainly, at ending words or pluralizing words or just being anywhere in the middle of a word. And, you know, you can't spell Scott without S. So I give some props for that. You know, I'm not going to pick what I was originally going to pick first. I was originally going to pick the letter E because I think it's just it's such an important letter to form words. And, you know, it's the I chart letter and everything. But I'm going to leave E as a free agent. And E is free to talk to you and me and see if it can work out a contract. But I'm going to take the letter K, dear to my heart, dear kitty. And, you know, it's a versatile letter in Scrabble. It works well with a couple of different letters. Now there's more two-letter words with K, including OK is good in Scrabble. Now, still not sure how I feel about that, but it's the only letter in Scrabble worth 5 points. It's got a neat sound to it. It's got a neat look to it. So in the fifth round, sign me up with the letter K. And, of course, baseball, it means a strikeout. And if you were lucky enough to see Dwight Gooden in the 80s or, you know, Roger Clemens in the 90s or Garrett Cole, maybe hopefully for the Yankees sometime this year, you'll see a bunch of K's hung up somewhere because that's how we, you know, we show how many strikeouts somebody is getting. So it's got baseball cachet as well. I will end our draft with the letter K.
That's good. And tomorrow morning I will eat some special K.
There you go. So tell us on Twitter. Go to Scott_Pianowski. Go to Dianagram and let us know what letters we got wrong. Let us know how your draft board differed with us. I've really enjoyed this, DB. This has been a blast. I knew it would be. Just give everybody a shout out on how they can keep up with you.
Okay. On Twitter, at Dianagram, DianaGram. My book, Hall of Name, is available on Amazon, on barnesandnoble.com, and also available at your local bookstore. You can also find me on Facebook if you feel like you want to get to know me a little better and you're not a serial stalker. If you're wanting to buy a book, a signed copy of my book, find me on Twitter or Facebook and I will give you details as to how to get a signed copy of Hall of Name. for yourself.
There you go. And I strongly recommend that. Again, you know, it's a labor of love from somebody who has been a huge baseball fan their entire life. And I guarantee that if you love baseball, if you love names, you're really going to enjoy this book. So this was a blast. I really enjoyed this conversation. I want to thank DB for their time today. I want to thank Raghu, our ace producer out in the West Coast, keeping us sounding good. Let's try to stay positive. Let's hope for the best. Maybe they can salvage 2020. If not, hopefully we can find a safe and happy way to get baseball going soon after that. I am Scott Pianowski. We'll have another guest for you next week. We'll talk baseball. We'll get silly. I'm not sure if we'll get as silly as this letter draft did, but we'll try to maintain that standard. This was a lot of fun. Keep those comments coming. Keep those ratings and reviews coming. Share this podcast if you like it. We enjoy that. And other than that, stay positive. We'll talk to you soon. Have a good night.
It's no secret that our world has been interrupted. A World Interrupted is a daily podcast telling stories of coronavirus and its impact on the economy. So subscribe today on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.